You are listening to KBOO Portland here on this Thanksgiving Day special. Next, in our final segment, we're going to listen to Dr. Michael Yellowbird speaking on decolonizing the mind, healing through neurodecolonization and mindfulness. This is a talk he gave, again, also at Portland State University on January 24th of this year, sponsored by Indigenous Nation Studies School of Social Work, Cultural Centers, and Cascadia Branch of the Environmental Club. Dr. Michael Yellowbird has taught at many universities. From 2009 to 2014, he was at the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University. And currently, he is at North Dakota State University in their Anthropology and Sociology Department. He works with oppressed communities of color, particularly Native American communities, bringing teaching as a healing the trauma of colonialism. He and others are currently part of building a social movement focused on decolonization. He presents direct practical steps to take towards ending colonialism, beginning with our own minds.
Tonight I want to talk a little bit about a topic that's I'm very passionate about, and it's looking at decolonization, something I've been writing about, something I've been talking about, something I've been really focusing on with tribal communities in my own life as well as with people that I know. And I want to talk a little bit about my work in neurodecolonization and mindfulness, and how, as I go through this talk, I want to talk about how I view neurodecolonization and the use of neurodecolonization by using indigenous contemplative practices as a political act of salvation and liberation from colonization. So this is some of the work that I do right now. I use traditional indigenous people's contemplative practices to heal the effects of colonialism. In this particular slide, you'll see one of my fellow tribesmen. Long before there was Buddha, long before Westerners started bringing Tibetan Buddhism and any other kind of Eastern philosophy here, indigenous people of these lands were engaged in contemplative practices. And you see this man here on the ceremonial lodge here in front of the sacred fire with his gourds singing these songs, but engaged in what I would call traditional mindfulness practices in our earth lodge. These pictures were taken in the early 1900s, late 1800s. I take neurodecolonization and mindfulness also in the work that I do to my classes. I make that a part of all of our classes because I know pretty clearly what happens to the mind and to the brain when you begin to stabilize the mind and the brain as you begin to quiet particular neural networks and you begin to activate other neural networks in the brain. And I want to talk a little bit about tonight how indigenous people did this. And I want to talk in particular to indigenous people and allies about how important it is to begin to return to these kinds of practices. Because I think that, again, these spiritual practices, these contemplative practices are probably the most powerful form of defense that we have against colonization. We do mindfulness at my home. And as you would expect, being a three-year-old and a one-and-a-half-year-old at this time, they get distracted every now and then. But it's something that I do with my daughters because I understand what it does to the executive function of the brain, how that when you sit in contemplation, that it begins to train your awareness, it begins to change the executive function of the brain, creating a greater sense of awareness in the world, a greater sense of confidence, a greater sense of emotional regulation, and a number of other things. I'm a strong advocate of this for people in tribal communities to return to this kind of practice. Before I get to that, we have to talk a little bit about why it is we have to get back to this practice. And I think the idea here is colonization. Colonization is not a thing of the past. It's something that is happening right now all across the world. But for a simple term, we're just looking at when people claim sovereignty over another and assert the social, political, economic, and spiritual domination over another group of people. And it's really motivated, it's very interesting to know this, it's motivated by the values of the colonizer in the belief that they are superior to the colonized. And this is very interesting because now you can actually look at brain scans today and you can see what people are, when you put them through certain tasks, about how they view other people. It's really interesting. Colonialism is really not a mainstream topic in social work in my profession. It seems to be more of a mainstream topic in indigenous studies. So probably seeing this, that the whole idea behind the chosen race was, you know, there was also a defiled race. And there you have God, go kill the Indians. And then you've got the Indians, wild and cruel. So the juxtaposition against one another, the good guys, the bad guys. So boarding schools were one of those things. I went to a boarding school. A lot of people that I knew went to boarding schools. And a lot of us suffered traumas in those boarding schools. It's unbelievable how many people don't know about boarding schools. But boarding schools not only happened here, they happened in Canada with First Nations people. They happened in Australia, New Zealand. And a lot of these indigenous people went through this same thing where they were getting whitewashed. And colonization, the mission of it was, of course, to kill the Indian, save the man. So there are different forms of colonization. Internal colonialism is something that we don't think about a lot. But as indigenous people, we think about it a lot because it really is about the management of indigenous people, the land, their territory, the flora, the fauna. And within the borders of the imperial nation, we have all these reservations. In California, we have these rancherias. Internal colonialism involves control. Prisons, schooling, policing, minoritarizing. And it's just this idea that, you know, for indigenous people, you've got boarding schools, federal Indian law, Western education, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the plenary power, the unlimited power of Congress over indigenous people, and reservations, Indian Child Welfare Act, and some of you may have heard of Baby Veronica recently, where the so-called Supreme Court took this case and they gave this baby, this indigenous baby, back to the adopted parents, right? So this is the idea that this internal colonialism is management of people. I want you to take a really close look at this because we're talking about modern day external colonialism, exploitation colonialism. The expropriation of fragments of indigenous worlds, animals, plants, human beings, extracting whatever in order to transport them to build wealth of the privileged, to feed the appetites of the colonizers who get marked as the first world. I'm actually from this part of the country in North Dakota. That's my reservation, the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. And if you know my reservation, you know there's just a few thousand people there. It's a very kind of, we're out on the plains, the Great Plains. But if you look at that light there from the sky, and then if you look down to the, if you look down to your right there, the next brightest light is Minneapolis, St. Paul. I wonder if you can tell me what's going on there. And why there's so much light, illumination in North Dakota on our reservation. Gas flaring going on, fracking's going on. You've got all this burning of natural gas that's going on. But I want to talk a little bit about that because it's not like they're doing it. It's like we're doing it. You see, a few generations ago, our grandmothers and grandfathers, great-grandparents said, we will not agree to drill Mother Earth. We will not agree to mine. We will not agree to, you know, steal these resources from Mother Earth. And I remember when I was a kid, folks fought that tooth and nail. They would not let them strip mine or drill for oil, all these elders. These are the people that were called the backward people, the uneducated, the people that didn't know anything, undeveloped, the savages, you might say, our great-grandparents. You take a few generations later, and you take those kids, you put them in schools, and you teach them about the bottom line is wealth. They forget who they are. The next thing you know, you got them drilling on their own property, fracking, putting dangerous chemicals into Mother Earth, polluting the land, the water, and we're heating up the planet. Biggest carbon footprint that you can imagine out there going on. It's like the Wild West going out there on my reservation right now. And who do you think gets most of the profits off of this oil that's going on? It's not the tribe. It's not the people. It's not the state of North Dakota. It's the multinational oil corporations that are getting all the profits out of there. The tribe gets a small bit, and the state gets their cut, even though it's not even on state land. We have to negotiate a deal with the state in order for this to all happen. Otherwise, the trucks cannot drive across that reservation line to haul that oil out. So we're screwed either way, right? That's external colonialism happening. I wrote 2012, it's 2014. And we haven't even got 1/4 way through the drilling that we're going to do. So think about it, that for a second. How do you turn a people into the people who love Mother Earth? They saw the Earth as alive. We've got all these stories. We've got all these songs, all these ceremonies. And they go back. They're really rich. It's amazing how rich some of these stories are. And some of the songs are, to even to plant corn and to plant the garden, that the women used to create all these songs, to even before they stepped on the planting ground. They had all these songs, corn songs, planting songs. They would go into these villages in the lodges, and where the women's lodge, and this time of the winter, they would sit and repose, eyes closed, singing to Mother Earth and singing to those plants, and they would visualize that corn growing in January when it was 40 below out on the plains. They were visualizing this, speaking to the earth. Sacred. How do you change people so quickly in a few generations now that they're drilling and they're tearing up and they're just ripping the soil up and injecting all kinds of chemicals in? And again, we have to be pretty clear, and I'm pretty clear, and I talk with people that colonization and colonialism is a very, very powerful instrument. So some of you have kind of got educated about settler colonialism, and these foreign family units move into a place and they reproduce. Imperial powers, this would happen on many reservations, tribal lands, oversees the immigration of people into our territories, and they build their homes there, right? Depopulation of our cultures happened, of the previous inhabitants, and the settlers take over the land. So this is always an interesting one for me because I work in the state of California, and I'm always interested to talk, you know, with people, because California is, of all the states, I don't know of a bloodier state than California when it comes to indigenous people. You know, the mass murders and genocides that happened up and down the coast, it's unbelievable when you look at it. So they destroyed indigenous people down there. And who did they destroy? Well, here's an example. In Los Angeles, when I was giving a talk, it was this Tongva people. And here's a quote from this book. Warfare was not frequent, and robbery, murder, and incest was rare. They did not believe in evil spirits or any concept of hell or devil until Spanish missionaries. Porpoises and owls were highly esteemed and were never killed. They introduced boys to manhood through fasting, hallucinogenic rituals, and trials of endurance. Now, when I talk to social workers about this in particular, I say, you know, because social workers and people in human services are always talking about evidence base of what works, evidence base. That's what kind of drives the world in human services and psychology and social work. I said, you know, when I think about this, do you know how old the evidence base of indigenous people ceremonies are? Thousands of years old, right? But you're telling me you want this project, you want, you know, the tribes to do this, and you've got an evidence base of, let's say, oh, you know, 6 months. I mean, that's colonialism. Settler colonialism happens at the level of social work, psychology, all these other human services from the federal government. So these are things I talk with people about in the communities. I said, listen, man, this is something you have to remember that is so important to return to these ideas, this way of life, these beliefs, right? You know what's interesting is you can't go into any Walmart or Walgreens or any store, hobby store, and find anything else that I found besides cowboys and Indians. You can't find African Americans and African American slave masters. You can't. I mean, that would be the equivalent, right? Yeah. Cowboys and Indians, because you're going to kill these Indians, the cowboys are. Or you can't go and you can't find Mexicans and the INS, or whatever they're called these days, you know, with all their toys in there and the infrared scopes to shoot the Mexicans, you know, when they're crossing the borders or the choppers. Certainly couldn't go into a store and find, you know, these little Jewish Holocaust prisoners and all these little play fences and these trains to take them to the, you know, the fires to be burned, you know, in these places. You can't find that. You can find cowboys and Indians, though. Toys of genocide, see? And this is one of the things that I've written about, talk about. It's like, you know, mascots. It's the same thing. It's all part of this settler colonialism, the master narratives of superiority and freedom and so on. So the point I'm trying to get at is that we as indigenous people see this stuff all the time. Repeated exposures over and over again. So it does, you know, some people call it microaggressions or assaults or whatever, but it's there all the time. So settler colonialism, this is one of the things that Tuck and Wang wrote about, was You know, the settlers are racially superior, giving their movements and political demands greater legitimacy than the colonized. This is really something I think that's important, is that they're not, settlers aren't immigrants. They're really founders. Not immigrants, you're founders, right? And they're not beholden to the laws of, and the epistemologies of the lands you migrate or to the indigenous people. But and settlers become the law. They create the law, right? Supplanting indigenous laws and epistemologies. Here's an example. If you look at these different kinds of laws, you've got the Indian Civilization Act of 1819. How offensive is that? The Removal Act of 1830. Ex parte Crow Dog. Folks know that case? Ex parte Crow Dog was Crow Dog versus Spotted Tail at one point. Crow Dog and Spotted Tail had a disagreement. These are Lakota people. Spotted Tail was dealing with a white man, breaking the laws and the rules of the Lakota people. So him and Crow Dog had an argument, and Crow Dog killed him. The families got together. They settled the matter. Crow Dog, it was decided, would pay for the death and take care of Spotted Tail's children. It was all settled and solved. The Americans came in, the federal, the U.S. came and said, that's not the way you handle justice. That's not civilized. Crow Dog has to hang. That was civilized, right? No peacemaking. So they actually took him, and then they jailed him, and they held a court, but they realized they didn't have no jurisdiction over Crow Dog. So he was released, but the presiding judge of the case, the Supreme Court, said, Congress, you don't have jurisdiction now, but if you assert jurisdiction, then you can have a jurisdiction over all of the federal crimes, the major crimes on reservations. That's a big deal, because now Indians at that point could no longer settle any of their own cases. They would have to go to a white man's court, and that is the way it is today. See? That's colonization. But think about it just for a second, how they managed that murder and how they made peace among the families, right? All this traditional thing they did made peace, solved it. Whites, the colonizer settlers came and said, that's not civilized. This man needs to hang. And now you've got a prison industrial complex. Long before there was a word of prison industrial complex, this was the beginning of it, with the indigenous people taking away. These are some of many laws that control indigenous people. I always like to make this point too. American internal colonialism is the colonizing of white folks by other white folks. And there was this big movement that went on for a while, kind of looked promising, the 99%, right? And then I said, well, we're going to call it the 98%, because the indigenous people are the other 1%. And then you've got the rich 1%, right? Because we're sovereign people. But we all know this story here. We look at the rise of income and the rise of power of the super rich. So if we look at subjugation of one group by another, this is the other 1%, as I said. U.S. government, the states, religious groups created poverty among indigenous people, put them on reservations, removed them from prime territories, destruction of resources and exploitation of the labor of people. We've got really horrible health right now. It's interesting, too, about health, because one of the fastest moving parts of decolonization that I see is people re-looking at ancestral health, ancestral diets, and decolonizing diets, and going back to what people used to eat. It's kind of like, what's interesting is I see a lot of people, like, they discovered what they call a paleo diet, right? Wow, you know, there's something novel, you know, that our ancestors used to do, and they say 10,000 years ago. I said, well, we used to do that just a few generations ago, before we were put on reservations and put on the standard American colonized diet from the food industry, where that's created horrible problems of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all kinds of autoimmune disorders. So it's really an important thing. Decolonization is kind of moving in that direction, which is really important. For the other 98%, you know, there's a lack of living wages, poverty, removing poor folks from their neighborhoods, gender inequalities in wages, all the exploitation of foreign labor, sweatshops, so on. Privileging the wealthy and the super wealthy, I think, is kind of what's going on now over the other 98%. So for the planet, colonization means this, and you've seen it, right? Global pollution now, dumping, hydraulic fracking, climate change, nuclear disasters, GMO. So decolonization, people talk a lot about decolonization, and I think it's important to know that, like, where did this term come from politically? Well, it's 1945. You saw almost a quarter of a billion people that were lived in territories that were under colonial rule. They were non-self-governing, and they were forced to be dependent or dependent on colonial powers. But in 1960, there was a shift by the General Assembly, and they adopted this declaration granting independence to colonial countries and people. What they said is all people have a right to self-determination, and colonialism should be brought to a speedy, unconditional end. This, of course, did not include the United States. Right? Because the United States does not see themselves as a colonizing power, only in the idea that they colonized Cuba and the Philippines, and they annexed, of course, Hawaii, which is still colonization. But they consider themselves liberated from the colonial status of England, right? So it's kind of an interesting, when you search the literature and look around, you're not going to find any scholars talking about this as a colonial context here. Decolonization is a word that's often misused. People are using it all the time, decolonize yoga or decolonize something. You know? But it's when you really think about it, and when you really use the term in the proper way, it's an unsettling kind of term, because really it involves a repatriation of indigenous people's lands. Give them back the resources. Give them back their lives. Give them back their rights. Give them back, right? It's when you free the colonized from the colonial control. And here's the crazy part about it, right? Because the Brits went through this, and when they gave up Hong Kong and they went in India, they went returned to their own homeland. This is not something that's going to happen in the United States. So people like Liz Cook Lynn and many others in indigenous studies argued that we're not in a post-colonial state, nor have we ever been in a post-colonial state here. We are embroiled against colonialism and battling, you know, just as much as Fanon would be battling for, colonialism in all these different ways. So here's some more definitions. Unsettling process, repatriation, you've seen that one. This is one where we talk about it in terms of social work. Restoration of cultural practices, thinking, beliefs, values that were taken away or abandoned during the colonization period. But they're still relevant today and necessary for survival and well-being. Decolonization, in my mind, is about the birth and the use of new ideas, thinking, technologies, lifestyles, that contribute to the advancement and the empowerment of indigenous people. There's another book that we just finished fairly recently. Decolonizing Social Work really points out the limitations and recognizes the imperialist frameworks in Western social work that must be contested on behalf of the populations that have been victimized rather than helped by these approaches. I'll go so far as to say that I think a lot of these approaches are bankrupt. They just don't make sense for indigenous people. I've been in the academy for 20 years as a social work professor. I believe that the liberation for indigenous people will come when they return to their own ceremonies, their own approaches. I don't think that there's much that Western social work or Western helping methods are going to do for us. So this is a definition by Dr. Joe Gahn. Intentional, collective, and self-reflective examination undertaken by these formerly colonized people. And it's about remedial action, traces continuity from the traditional pre-colonial experience, and embarks upon distinctive, self-determined, purposeful, post-colonial experiences. And the key, you know, that Wasiatuwin and I wrote about in 2005 is that community emancipation from hegemony is the key, right? This is the key. We have to get communities to begin to pull away and then to begin to rebuild themselves. In decolonization, there's this idea that there are three M's. The mass, which is the colonial lands, the resources, the main political security or the politics, financial institutions. You could say the mass on my reservation is also about the colonial lands, the control of those colonial lands. Traditional approaches of colonialism focus on these areas, controlling this all these resources, right? In my particular field, social work is involved in the area of security, justice systems with youth and so on, but rarely is social work involved in indigenous and land and resource rights, protection, repatriation, or support of political sovereignty. The second M is the mind, which is, it's really kind of a newer part of decolonization, decolonizing the mind. So it's freeing this post-colonial culture and thought from dependence on Western ideas, philosophies, values, beliefs, theories. I've kind of used my work to move my thinking in that direction, decolonizing the mind in terms of neurodecolonization. The mind is an area that social work becomes more involved in. But again, like as I was saying, the tendency is to use Western methods. And I'll give you an example as I go along, because in order to heal the mind, it's a lot different than sitting in a clinical social worker's office or a psychologist's office for an hour and having so many sessions that are paid for by your insurance agency or something. You know, it's a very, very different model. So the last one is the metropole, the empire. So decolonization here involves freeing the metropole from its tendency to inferiorize and dominate other people and territories. That's quite a job here to try to influence, you know, decision makers up there. How do you stop war? How do you stop, you know, colonizing? Right? So I just want to show you a little bit what we're doing at Humboldt State to decolonize a bit of our curriculum. This is our statement, our MSW program. So we really privilege and actively support the sovereignty, the well-being and spirituality, land rights of indigenous people, especially those in Northern California. Recognizing that social practices, approaches, and theories in the United States developed from a Western perspective are imperialist and really not relevant or supportive of indigenous peoples. So the other thing we're really doing is working with indigenous communities to implement traditional practices, philosophies into the community, contemporary context, for the purpose of healing community empowerment. And another thing that we're really focusing on is getting students to think about the rights of Mother Earth, how important the protection of Mother Earth is, just like you would protect a child and child welfare, that we should be working to protect Mother Earth. All right, so I'm going to shift now into kind of the work that I've been doing now. The work that I'm doing now has a lot to do with using traditional ceremonies, training the mind and the brain to heal from the trauma of colonization. I want to say that the mind, the brain, is the most powerful ally that we have. It's incredible what the mind can do if you start looking at the research. I just want to give you a couple of examples. Candace Pert was a neuroscientist. She used to work for the National Institute on Health. Now she's got her own organization. She was interviewed by Bill Moyer back in 1990 in a book called Healing and the Mind. And she talked about the literature about what they used to call multiple personality disorders. It's very interesting because she said that people with multiple personality disorders can let's say, two or three personalities. And one personality could have cancer. And one can have diabetes, and one could be free from all these kinds of things. But the second that that person moves from not having any disease into being, let's say, Mo, Larry, and Curly, right? So when Mo has nothing and he moves into being Larry, cancer shows up on the MRI and on the x-rays. When he becomes Curly, maybe he has diabetes and cancer. But when he goes back to his personality as Mo again, what do you think happens? Yeah, he's clean. There's no trace of it, right? So this is the kind of stuff that we're finding out in neuroscience now, that the body has this capacity to heal. It's unbelievable. And I believe that indigenous people tapped into that. I know they tapped into that. And this is way beyond what we're talking about now. This goes so far beyond what we understand in the academy, is that we're moving into a place that, you know, was only inhabited by New Agers at one time. Right. Now it's inhabited by, you know, so-called serious science. So neurodecolonization is kind of what I talk about, but it's this idea that we can encourage growth in networks in our brain that are beneficial. We can train our attention to engage in optimistic thinking that enables a belief that colonialism can be overcome. It's all part of a systematic training of the brain. Develop the courage to confront it and cultivate the creativity, because the human brain is so intelligent, needed to use novel, effective approaches to change it. So the philosophy is kind of what, maybe you've heard this term, neuroplasticity. The brain is plastic, it can change with experience. It's very powerful. So we say, in order for it to begin, it has to first begin in our minds, decolonization. That's my belief now. You can have all kinds of decolonization programs, whether it's language, whether it's decolonizing your diet or whatever, But the first order of business is to decolonize the mind. It's important, and this is what I'm telling people in tribal communities, to create these healthy decolonized thinking patterns and actions. As we do that, we positively shape and empower important neural networks in the brain. It provides us with personal resources and strengths, whatever we need to overcome colonialism. On the flip side, and this is what colonialism has done, it's made us angry. It's made us victims. Rage. Grief. Got all these things among indigenous people, right? So it's like our ancestors said, our relatives said, you know, think positive. Set that aside. See the goal, see the vision and the ceremony. Because we know now today with neuroplasticity, they call the plasticity paradox, the more you have unconstructive negative thinkings and feelings and behaviors, the more you short circuit and dampen those neural networks that are going to help liberate you from that oppression. There's optimistic networks in different parts of the brain, like in the anterior cingulate cortex of the insula, compassion, self-awareness, neurons that live there. But we as indigenous people have been, you know, so at the end of colonialism that we, you know, have given into stress, to fear, to failure, complacency, right? But the answer is in our ceremonies, in our culture. So now I want to kind of move a little bit into why I think that neurodecolonization is a political act. It's a very powerful political act. Because spiritual movements and traditional ceremonies of indigenous people have always been a form of successful resistance, which is why our ceremonies were so viciously attacked, outlawed. Now they say, oh, you can, Indian Religious Freedom Act, you can practice your ceremonies. But that was after a point of criticality when all the people that could run the ceremonies were all jailed and dead, right? Colonialism took care of that. But here's a picture of some of my tribal people around the Tree of Life, right? But here's just a small example of all of the ceremonies that have been used in resistance ways. The sun dance, ghost dance, big drum ceremonies, longhouse ceremonies, smokehouse ceremonies. These are all from different tribes. Dream dances go up and down along the coast. Medicine lodge ceremonies from all different tribes. Right? These are what people did. These are the things that were outlawed. Right? And they changed the brain so much that when we did our book, I'm going to take a look at this book here. My brother, Monty Yellowbird, he drew this picture. And you see this picture, I asked him to. I said, draw the brain, indigenous brain here, and how it's getting healed. So he drew the brain with all these cortices here, the prefrontal cortex and the occipital lobe and all these other lobes there. But here he has two healers working in the brain. See, one is singing to the brain with the gourd. And the other is fanning the brain with his eagle feathers. See? And what he's doing, what they're doing is they're releasing these neurons in the form of horses. See? Coming from all the cortices of the brain, going back to the old way of life. See? Returning. And there, that woman, this woman who makes everything grow in our tribe, she's touching like the four directions. And you see life coming there. We understand indigenous women have this capacity to make life, to make things grow, right? We have to understand that. So in this particular picture, he did this ledger drawing on ledger paper, and he did it for a particular reason, because to show that the ceremony is on top of the colonization. See, the ledger paper is the ledger paper that came with the colonizers and the settlers. And this is where they ordered sort of supplies at the forts when they gave the Indians the bad food and the bad stuff, right? And so he drew on top of that this design. So this is the cover of our book, Decolonizing the Mind, for Indigenous Minds Only. This is the brain on ceremony. Now we'll start talking about some of the things that are going on. These are some of the grandmothers that are I forget what they call themselves, but there's, I think, 13 grandmothers. I know some of these ladies. And they're going around, and they're doing all this. It's like a revival, I think, in this way. But if you take a look at the brain scans here, this is a scan that one of my colleagues, Andrew Newberg, sent me, and it's a baseline scan and then a prayer scan. And if you can look at that, you can see that the prayer scan, that part on the left side of the brain is more activated when a person is in prayer. It becomes more activated. And what that does is it has a tendency then to begin to activate in this person a sense of well-being, good feelings, good thoughts, begins to release important chemicals, like serotonin, for instance, or dopamine, or those feel-good chemicals. And the more the person does it, the stronger that particular lobe becomes. So it was interesting when you go back into the history books and you look at, you know, say, these Indians, when you met these Indians, they were very silent. They didn't say anything. Quiet people. But I realize now why they were, because when they were sitting there in these conversations with settler colonials, what they were doing is they were shifting a lot of their energy and their resources and the hemodynamic activity to the right side of their brain. That's part of the brain is involved with creativity. And whenever they went and sat down and they listened for a long time what the colonizer had to say about selling land or making deals with them, they would say, okay, well, we've heard enough. Let's go away and think about this for a while. And in order for that right side of the brain to become activated, you have to quiet down this very task-oriented left side of the brain. That's now neuroscience. It's always judging and classifying and discriminating. The right side of the brain activates and it begins to think about creativity, and you get the aha moments for the right side of the brain, which is why when indigenous people left those councils, they would sit on the side of the hill by the river, they would be out on the plains, and why that creativity would begin to happen in that part of the brain was the activation of the brain by the blood flow, the hemodynamic and electrical activity in the brain. God wasn't known as, for most of them, known as like a single supreme being. God was whatever it was. It was the whole universe, really. In the idea, we didn't have a name for God. We just had a name for like these forces that move things, right? And it's interesting because I could get into this whole discussion about how people, you know, saw rain and how they actually made it rain and what the things that they did and how they communicated with the systems around them to make it rain. They didn't think about it in terms of an act of God. Again, it's very different from tribe to tribe. Let me go on here. So let me get into some of this other part of this research on mindfulness that seems to be a good proxy for indigenous people. So we know this, that after 11 hours of sitting doing mindfulness practice, 30-minute sessions, 22 sessions, I guess, you would see positive changes in the white matter of the brain. The white matter of the brain is really important because it increases the what they call the myelin sheath in the brain and the nerves, and the messages go back, you know, much more quickly. And it facilitates that, so the brain is talking to itself. It's getting more and more aware. And if you can imagine people doing that for long, long periods of time, the only baseline we have now are Tibetan monks, those studies that have gone on. But again, this indigenous people, you would see this kind of thing happen in most indigenous cultures where that white matter was probably very well developed. And the other thing, probably, this is why people didn't suffer from neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease, because Parkinson's is a disease that attacks the myelin sheath in the brain, eats it up, so it creates these cracks in the nerves, and that's why people get spasmodic and have problems. Significant changes, you can see that in weeks, a matter of weeks. So you're sitting in mindfulness meditation, or if you're doing these ceremonies for 8 weeks, only 45 minutes a day, all these structures associated with memory, your sense of self, empathy, stress, those are all changed. And what happens is your levels of stress go down, your sense of memory and your ability to remember goes up, your sense of self becomes more defined, your level of empathy becomes more defined. I want to give you an example of this. When I was talking with Yupik elders, it's got two things to do, I think, with gray matter. It was a very interesting story because it also has to do with mirror neurons. Those are the neurons we have in our brain that have to do with compassion and empathy. These older ladies are telling me that, you know, a lot of times when they walk along the beach, and they're collecting wood or they're collecting along the shores, sometimes they stop and they look at a particular piece of wood and they talk and they go and they turn that wood over. And I said, why do you do that? They said, because that wood's been laying on its side for a long time and it must be tired of laying on its side for a long time. And I said, oh, you know, that's what the neuroscience, they call mirror neurons. Your mirror neurons have gone past, you know, the empathy for people, but it's gone into this other world that we call the inanimate world, that they can empathize with things that we think are inanimate. I mean, that was amazing to me. And how long have you been doing that? Forever, right? So their mirror neurons are well developed, and they can see these things that most of us can't see because they're in that kind of life all the time. This is another part of doing these contemplative and neural decolonization, the insula. Conflict-related insula, this part of the brain helps us when we have conflict. And when we do enough ceremony, we can deal with different ideas that are opposing ours or things that we're conflicted with. They're easier to understand. And when this part of the brain is developed, we have a greater sense of ourself and how we're feeling from moment to moment as we experience who we are. And when you talk with people that are very spiritual people that do a lot of ceremony or mindfulness, sacred ceremony, you find that they have a very, very deep sense of their selfness, who they are and where they are in the world. And sometimes they'll say, well, I'm like this in the world. They can't even see themselves as having any major place in the world, but they see themselves as just a small speck in the world, right? On the flip side of that, you think, well, other people want to be like on the top of the world, or they want to be the center of the world, right? It's a very different viewpoint with indigenous people. So again, this is my fellow tribesmen here, looking at the language center here, the brain on the left side of the cortex here, the rear side of the cortex, what they call the occipital lobe or the parietal lobe. And you see that language center there. As he sits there and he sings a song, over and over again, that language part, that prayer part, become very strong, right? The TPJ becomes activated when people do meditation. This is a really important part of the brain because it helps us to have the ability to have emotional intelligence, the ability to perceive the emotional and mental state of others. I would judge that when people were colonizing here, that this part of the brain wasn't activated. They could not empathize with indigenous people. They could not perceive the emotional state that people were in when they were taking and stealing children out of their homes and putting them in boarding schools. You might say that they had brain disorder this time. Even when meditators are not meditating, this part of the brain is more activated, right? And this is, again, very important. This is a real special picture here in a couple of ways. These are people from my tribe. First thing you look at these guys, you think, well, these guys look like they belong to a CrossFit gym. So they're like paleo Indians. Well, of course they were. They wild game. They gathered wild plants. They gathered wild fruits. They ate everything. You might say it's free range, organic, everything. But these guys are older guys. These guys are guys in their 60s and 70s. Some of them are a little younger in this picture. And they're singing to a sacred cedar tree. This is a really important picture because this is what helps me, and I think it starts connecting the dots for a lot of indigenous people. When they start singing to that tree, they sing directly to that tree. They speak to that tree. They tell the tree how beautiful the tree is. They call the tree sister, mother, brother. Mother a lot of times, like they sing. And they sing over and over and over again. They don't sing for 45 minutes, like we do in meditation. They don't sing for 30 minutes. They sing for hours. They sing for days, weeks, months. Singing to the cedar tree was a 90-day ceremony where they would get up every day, sing to that tree for for 90 days. They knew they had to sing with passion and honesty because that tree was listening. Right? So what's amazing about this then is that parietal lobe, you see what's happening to their brains? You see on that right side how it's gone quiet? The parietal lobe is a lobe in the brain that helps us with our spatial reasoning. It helps me make sure that I'm not, you know, part of this desk, or I'm not part of that tree out there. I'm me here. But if I go out with my fellow tribesmen and I sing to this tree over and over and over again, and it becomes a being to me, pretty soon that distance begins to fade as that parietal lobe goes quiet. That spatial reasoning is gone. I become the tree. I become the fragrance. I become the bark, the roots. The tree becomes me. Right? And so we sing and sing and sing. Neuroscience has now finally caught up, knowing what was going on in their brains. See, missionaries and settlers would come by and say, look at those Indians worshiping that tree. What they didn't understand, what was going on, was that they were having an actual communication with the tree. Now, I could tell you a lot of stories about a lot of medicine people long ago who could speak to the trees or the winds and stuff. You think that's a myth or Hollywood? It's not. People entered into this state, a different state, transcending this their human. And something about what we have as human beings, as indigenous people, maybe as all people, is we have this capacity to empathize and understand and connect so that there's a conversation that happens. That's true. I don't doubt that for a second. So when you see that parietal lobe go quiet as those songs go on and on, you know that that person has made that connection. Now, we live in a world where this is rarely possible. Who's going to go out there and sing to the spring on this campus, the fresh water for 90 days, and talk to it? How it feels. Right? Well, we've got these things we've got to do. Rush, rush, rush. So that hemodynamic activity, the blood flow, electrical flow, doesn't allow that to happen. This is another Arikara man. Sacred object meditation. He's in one of our earth lodges here. What's he? You can see what he's gazing at? Maybe see? Pipes. How many? Anybody see? Seven. Got seven pipes. Sacred number among a lot of native people. But here's something that's going on pretty incredible in his brain, because he's not just sitting there looking at these pipes. He's getting into this really deep object meditation. And as he's looking at these pipes, something's starting to happen to the attention area and also the visual area, the back of his brain called the occipital lobe. You see the attention area on the left side, prefrontal cortex, connect. You see that? When he's doing the meditation. What we know now from neuroscience, what we knew way back then, even before there was such a thing as neuroscience, is that when that connection happens, that a person transcends this area of being here and rises to this level of, you know, happiness, joy, optimism, feelings of well-being. A lot of this study and research has been done by Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin now. But now we know this. We already knew what they were doing, right? And as he does this, more and more that connection gets stronger and stronger. And I like to tell people, I say, I'll bet you, I want to put this evidence base against evidence base that you have. I want to compare and see what happens, what the outcome is going to be. If we can get this man or this person to overcome depression, anxiety, self-deprecation, internalized racism, or even fear, anxiety, whatever it is. To me, it's a no-brainer, no pun intended. That this is going to happen to his brain. And the more he does it, the stronger that connection gets. And in fact, after a while, he doesn't even have to do this because that connection is so strong. He's going to be walking around with this sense of well-being, of joy, optimism, happiness on the brain. It's a ceremony. It's a practice, but you just can't get a grant, a federal grant, and can have kids on the weekend do it. It requires going back to what we know, period. Here's the other part. Look at the back of his brain. You see that red there in the very back? That's called the occipital lobe. That's the part of the brain that sees, that makes sense of the world. And you see on the meditation side, the occipital lobe has become more activated. That means he's seeing something more than those pipes there. He's seeing beyond. What do you think he's seeing? You know what he could be seeing? He could be seeing that this pipe, you look at the pipe, the bowl part of it, where it comes from, this pipestone, coming from Mother Earth, the blood of Mother Earth. He could be so deep into that at this point, in that stem, extending up to the universe to make the prayer powerful. He could see these pipes and all the ancestors that gave him these pipes. He could look at all their faces, all the attitude. He could pick up on all the nuances, and all of the different kinds of things that they were thinking or feeling when these pipes were passed down. How powerful is that? He's in that lodge. He's doing that. So he's seeing beyond, way beyond. We all do it. All we have to do is kind of sit and maybe look at a picture of our grandmother, and we may see glimpses of her smiling, or our brother or sister or someone we cherish and love, right? But he's doing it as a ceremony over and over and over and over again. That was the discipline. That was the ceremony. So this is a little bit about songs to Mother Earth. These, again, my fellow tribesmen here. These are older guys. They need to visit the gym a little more, I suppose. But they are, these are elders. These guys in their 70s. They're not like me. They have black hair yet. But you look at the brain at rest and the brain's reaction to music. There you see a whole cascade of things happening. That's why we like music. But if that music makes sense to you, and if you use music as a form of liberation, which they were doing as a form of prayer and connection, the human brain looks like this when you get into that level, right? So again, it was one of those things. Intuitively, settlers knew this, so they wanted to take away the music of the people. That's the thing that was going to create liberation, resistance. You know, it was to the point where I remember when I was teaching at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, I got to hear the stories of First Nations people there and the kids that went to boarding school and how they made them lose their songs and language. These little kids, 5 years old, they used to take those kids when they caught them speaking their language out on the playground, they would whip them. And then they would put them into solitary confinement and starve them. And one of my friends who was actually in a residential school told me, he said, the third time they caught us, he said, they used to take big darning needles that long and stick them through our tongue all the way through. He said, and he was telling my students this, he said, you know, Mike, it works. You never want to speak your language again. You never want to sing your songs again. So if you think about what music did for people and how it was a form of liberation, as a colonizer, you would not want people to have that, right? So these are things that I tell Indigenous people and communities. So I'll kind of get to why decolonization is so difficult, happening in the brain, called it brain disorder, colonial brain disorder, I call it. So when the orbital frontal cortex, right here, if you just run your finger across here, that's your orbital frontal cortex. It's like a dorsal lateral two cortex. This part of the brain has to be activated in order for us to do critical thinking, to evaluate ourselves and our effect on others. The interesting thing is that it's called the above average effect that happens there, because a lot of us don't go to our true capacities. We don't. We think we're better than we are, we're smarter than we are, we're better looking than we are. We see the world through rose-colored glasses a lot of times. I'm a better driver than these people, or smarter student, whatever. This is the finding in some of the research, right? And here's the kicker. When you take people and you tell them that they are the right color, they have the right values and beliefs, they live in the greatest country on earth, and they are from an exceptional class of people, they're going to have even more difficulty engaging this brain region which requires critical thinking. That's why I call it a brain disorder, right? Consequences are they're going to lack the ability to critique their privilege, their culture, their beliefs, values, and their nation's failures and weaknesses. This is another a neuromodulator that also prevents decolonization from happening. We all have it, but some of us are more abundant in it. And people that have higher status and are in more control of their lives and believe in the values of the society. People that have higher status and are in more control of their lives and believe in the values of the society. The break stops even harder. So here you have on your right side a little black snake called a crate. It's an African snake, and it has its venom is a neurotoxin. So it bites you. What happens is that the venom travels up and it gets to your brain, and it tells you your brain shuts off your breathing, your heart, you know, all your functions. Interestingly enough, we have that same neurotoxin in our brain. It's called LINX1. It's a neuromodulator. And what happens is that when any new information comes into us that we disagree with, LINX1 puts the brake on it. So when you come from a society that believes in this God and these values and ever, and this way of life, and you meet another people that are different from you, LINX1 is going to put on the brakes, and you're not going to be able to, you know, meet these people, because that neuromodulator can't take in that information. It's another brain disorder that we have as people. That's why all the studies that are going on with mirror neurons are showing that we cannot empathize with other people unless we're around those other people enough. There's a lot of studies that have gone on where a lot of white subjects have been shown pictures of black folks. Martin Luther King is one where people, you know, their mirror neurons will go on, so the empathy, say, well, we recognize him. You show him another strange black face, the participant, mirror neurons shut off. No empathy. They can't connect. And that's especially true, you know, with folks that have no experience with other culture or no one else, right?
You just finished listening to a recording of a talk by Dr. Michael Yellowbird called Decolonizing the Mind, Healing Through Neurodecolonization and Mindfulness. You just finished listening to a special program this Thanksgiving morning on KBOO, Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. I wanted to let you know that you can find all the recording podcasted online of all the different broadcasting with it this morning. KBOO.FM is where you want to go. I want to thank Steve Nassar and Rock Bergeron for engineering this morning. Also, the whole